Thanks for tuning into Americana Music Profiles. The next episode starts right now.
You're tuned in to another edition of Americana Music Profiles, brought to you by Americana Rhythm Music Magazine and AmericanaMusicMagazine.com. I'm your host, Greg Tutwiler. Let's jump right in to the next exciting interview. In this episode of Americana Music Profiles, we catch up with musician, composer, visual artist, and former president of the Colorado Bluegrass Music Society, Kevin Slick. Kevin's career spans several decades, and his musical approach, several different iterations. His latest is with his bluegrass band, Orchard Creek Band. Kevin joins us to talk about their new album, Listening for Your Call. Kevin, hi. Welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
Thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to chat with us today. I have been looking forward to this interview. You and I have crossed paths in different ways over the years and haven't had a chance to do this, so I appreciate it.
Yeah. Nice to be here. Nice to have a chance to talk about some new music.
Yeah. You've been at this a while, though, right, as a musician?
Yeah. I have been playing music professionally, either full-time or part-time, for about 40 years, I suppose, now.
Wow.
And, a lot of it's been in all sorts of different genres. In the last 20 years or so, it's been primarily the Americana or folk bluegrass kind of world. Living out here in Colorado, the bluegrass scene is... Well, it's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's the best way to say it.
Yeah, that's cool. What part of the country did you grow up in?
I grew up in Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania as a child, and then lived in Philadelphia for many years, and then New York City before coming out here to Colorado.
Have you always been a musician? I think I read where you also have had a career as an illustrator. Is that right?
Yeah, I work as a visual artist, and I have worked in the past as a school teacher. I'm retired now, teaching both sort of general classroom and then teaching art.
Okay.
But I've been a visual artist for all of my life, really, too. And I like to tell people that I became a musician on February 9th, 1964, when I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show when I was 5 years old.
Wow.
That's when I realized that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, that's cool.
Some way or another. Yeah.
So what happened from there? What was the next phase into the music career for you?
Well, I started playing guitar probably, when I was 12, 13, that sort of thing. I think one of the things that was the real change, because I was always interested in writing songs, and I wrote songs down, and I made up songs and things like that, was in the mid-80s when Tascam and some of these other companies introduced the multi-track cassette recorders.
Oh, yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, and suddenly it was possible for someone like myself to... with not a lot of investment in terms of equipment, make recordings.
Yeah.
And that coincided wonderfully with the emergence of the cassette as kind of the dominant music format that, that was being sold in stores. And so suddenly people like myself could make a recording of original songs. And again, investing a little bit of money in getting a cover printed for it and things like that, create a cassette that you could sell in a store, and it looked not that different from, Bruce Springsteen's latest cassette or whoever is out there. Whereas prior to that, it was the idea, well, you had to have something pressed on vinyl, and that was prohibitively expensive, and there just wasn't many places you could do it. Again, suddenly it was, and this sort of coincided with the punk movement, the DIY movement, which I think was phenomenal because
oh my gosh, yeah.
and people putting out zines and books and videos and such like that. It was very much the democratization, I think, of sharing art, whether recorded art, books, whatever. And, you know, of course, the downside of it, I was writing for several music magazines at that time, was, you know, I'd get like 200 cassette releases a month to review, because it was easy to do, and so everyone was doing it. Yeah. But you know, on the whole, I'd say it's a good thing that things have become easier for people to share what they create.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little behind you in all of that, but I'm was in a lot of that as well. And there are times that I miss those days. Those were the early days of, as you said, of all of that. And you know, it was fun to be a part of that world in MySpace as well. The artists today have their own interpretation of music, but they won't ever get to experience that. You know, it was a different world back then. It was cool.
Yeah. I think there was an energy that was wonderful, and maybe it's just the newness of it that that people were. Well, let's check this out. This is interesting. And you know, again, the downside, perhaps now, being that there's so much that it can just feel overwhelming. Yeah. When you think like, wow, I'd love to hear new music, but you know, they just added 20,000 new songs to Spotify yesterday. How am I ever going to listen to everything that's
right
out there?
I agree. It's great that everybody has the opportunity to create, but it sure also creates an arena where a lot of things get lost, I'm afraid. That's the other side of it. But, you know, it's okay. It will find, serendipitously, it will find where it's supposed to be, so.
Yeah, I agree.
So you in your earlier days then were kind of more in the folk scene. Am I understanding that correctly? Folk rock.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I first started playing guitar, playing acoustic guitar, you know, very influenced by Bob Dylan, Neil Young, you know, that sort of thing. And so that's just kind of naturally where I gravitated towards. I played music more full-time for a while with a group called Neo Pseudo that some friends and I had created, which was perhaps a little bit more electric and a little more rock. In recent years, I've gone much more to the bluegrass and folk, back to the, you know, my roots in the folk world, very influenced by people like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and that sort of thing. And I love, in the bluegrass world, I love the community aspect of it.
Absolutely.
I love the fact that people just get together and jam, and we get together and play. It doesn't matter if it's the simplest two-chord old song. There's that community connection with people, and it's wonderful. And, you know, on a very practical level, when I was playing music full-time, I had, as part of what I went to every gig with, a 6-string acoustic, a 12-string acoustic, a Les Paul, a Telecaster, an acoustic amp, a rack of effects, and a Fender Twin Reverb. And now I mostly just carry a mandolin, which is, I feel like I have achieved some wisdom with my age.
Yeah, a whole lot easier.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Were you always aware of the bluegrass scene, or was there a moment in your life where you kind of discovered that side of the music?
I had heard it a lot growing up because my father was a big fan of it and played particularly the Country Gentleman records a lot.
Yeah, which was a different kind of bluegrass.
Yeah. I didn't really realize until later that was kind of a progressive bluegrass of its era.
Uh-huh.
And we went to see different acts at a place called Sunset Park, which was down on the Pennsylvania-Maryland border. So I have pictures of myself, you know, at 8 years old with Flat and Scruggs and people like that
that
we used to go
see
regularly there. But I didn't quite relate to it that much. I was probably more interested in listening to pop music as a child. I guess a couple things that were really made a difference. Certainly the Will the Circle Be Unbroken album.
Sure. Yeah.
Was huge for me because I was a fan of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and had several other albums. And so when that came out, it was, oh, well, that's the latest album by these guys. I like these guys. Let's check it out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems kind of funny now to think about something as simple as like just the way they look and dressed. Mm-hmm. But it was like, well, I didn't quite relate to these guys all with the crew cuts and the, you know, suit coats and things like that. But the guys with long hair and, you know, t-shirts, that made yeah. sense to me.
Yeah.
And so I started listening and enjoying it. And then I think when I was in college, probably like a lot of people hearing a lot more folk music and traditional musics, I began to appreciate bluegrass kind of in the same way that I appreciated punk rock.
Uh-huh.
Was the intensity of it. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
I started listening to people like John Duffy singing, and you know, I just thought, wow, this is powerful. Yeah. This is like really, this is as powerful as the Ramones or anything else that's going on right now.
Yeah. Wow, that's cool. So yeah. Then it sounds like about 20 years maybe ago you headed west Colorado because you had discovered that scene, or was it a little more intentional than that?
It was moving here was really primarily I guess twofold. One, just this you know, living in the New York metro area, working there, was just a pretty frenetic lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still a little jarring. I was teaching downtown on 9/11. I was teaching fourth grade that day, and so having gone through that experience, and then the sort of follow up afterwards, where it was like you kept surgical gloves by the mailbox when you're checking the mail because you were afraid someone was going to be sending you anthrax and all that stuff. Was just a little, just grinding. It sort of you know, wanted to get out of that. And my son was just, you know, a baby at that point in time, and thought it would be nice to live someplace where going out and doing outdoor kind of activities was just a normal thing that people did.
Mm.
It wasn't like a big deal.
Yeah,
and that you could go skiing, for example, on a Saturday afternoon if you wanted to, rather than, oh, we've got to make plans, you know, 2 months in advance to go ski somewhere or something like that.
Right, right.
You could do that sort of thing. So that was the main impetus of moving here. And I knew people here. I mean, I knew some of the people that were here, like Pete Wernick and folks like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew there was certainly a bluegrass scene going on here, but I didn't really know until I got here how in depth it was, how involved the jam scene was in terms of pretty much any night of the week. And it's more or less come back since the pandemic, but
uh-huh.
prior to that, certainly any night of the week in the Denver Boulder metro area, you could probably find two or three good jam sessions to go to and, you know, play music.
That's
and
cool.
with great people, a lot of whom, you know, professional players. And then, you know, add on top of that, the people that come to town for Rocky Grass or something.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah, that's true.
You
yep.
know, and then you just think, wow, this is, yeah, this is pretty great. And it's pretty easy to get to know people and get connected.
So your latest project is with the band called Orchard Creek. And is that a fairly mm-hmm. new venture for you with this group, or have you guys been together for a while?
We've been together for a while. We were certainly together before the pandemic. You know, it's funny how like you look back, you think, was that 2 years ago or 5 years ago?
I know.
because there's that big gap in time
where
you sort of lost track of things. But yeah, I started playing with the group. They were at that point a quartet, guitar, banjo, bass, and Dobro. And I knew, of course, knew the people in the band, or at least some of them pretty well. And they had said, hey, you know, we're playing at this venue. Can you come on out and watch the show and just give us some feedback?
Okay.
So I did. And the first thing I said was, wow, I love the original songs. These are some great songs and some great singers. I think the rhythm could use a little tightening up. You need a mandolin player in there chopping. And so they said, well, do you want to play mandolin with us? And so I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Right. And so hint, hint.
Started doing, yes, exactly. Started doing that. That must have been like 2018, 2019, I guess. yeah, so we've been playing for a while now. And we did some recording a couple years ago, just recorded about four or five songs, put out as an EP. And then we just put out our first full-length album,
right.
12 songs on it. And I think it's quite good, if I can be so modest or humble. Or particularly what I enjoy is there's four of us in the band. Jan Springer plays guitar, Dave Richardson, banjo, Keith Murdoch, dobro player, and myself, who are pretty active songwriters.
Okay.
And so you get four different sets of songwriters inputting into it. And basically, we did a fairly democratic setup for this album. We said, well, there's, and at that particular time, we were looking for a bass player. We were kind of auditioning new bass players. So there was really just four of us. And we had, you know, some different people playing bass. We said, okay, well, let's put 12 songs on this album. Everyone, you get three picks. You know, what are the three songs you want to put on?
Yeah,
it?
Okay.
Whether original or not. And and then that was basically the how we started from there.
Okay.
And we've since added a wonderful bass player named Todd. Todd Ball is a great bass player playing with us these days. So. That's our current lineup, yeah.
And the name of the album, Listen to Your Call, is that right?
Listening for Your Call, yeah.
Listening for Your Call.
Listening for Your Call is one that I wrote, and it's a song I wrote with Mike Mitchell, who has been getting a lot of great airplay for his recent recordings in the bluegrass world. And Mike did a great job because I had the idea for the song, but needed some help crafting it. I mean, the story behind the song was back in 2020, I was talking to my dad on the phone, lived back in Pennsylvania, and he was basically in hospice at that time. And we were talking and about ready to finish up the call. And I said, well, you know, I'll try calling like the next day or 2 days or whatever. And he said, okay, well, I'll be listening for your call.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, wow, that's a beautiful line. I'll write it down. And as it turned out, that was the last time I was able to actually talk with him
because he
passed away very soon after that.
Yeah.
So I had this idea for the song, but all these different feelings and ideas and things. And Mike was great at helping me pare it down and make it, you know, singable, make it into a song that would work and would still include, you know, some of the references, like there's a line in there, I'll be listening for your call when Hank sings so lonesome. Referring to Hank Williams,
sure,
my dad's favorites. And your voice will be there like a ripple in still water. Well, my dad's favorite song was Ripple by the Grateful Dead.
Okay.
And so, you know, he was great at helping me craft things like that.
Yeah.
That could just sound nice and sing nice. But when I sing it, I know
where
it's coming from.
Yeah. Wow. That's cool.
And it's a challenge at times. It's when we were recording it, the first two times I just couldn't get through it at all.
Yeah,
and
I can imagine.
My partner Vicky was out in the control room, and I heard her saying to him, "Like he's not going to make it. He's in it."
Oh man!
But what I did was I sort of stopped and thought, "Okay, I'm in a Broadway play, right? And this guy is singing this song, and this is the story behind the song." And I just sort of put myself in the place of, I'm playing the part of someone singing this song.
Okay, yeah.
And it was able to work. And afterwards, everyone was out there and was like, "You never sang it like that before." And I never had to.
Right.
Try to sing like that before.
Oh, man. So the album, Not Quite Out, comes out in October. Is that right?
September. September 1st, it'll be on September. All the streaming,
okay.
Streaming services.
Yeah. Okay. How can people get in touch with you, find the band, look for the album? What's the best place to get all that?
Well, for me, it's kevinslick.com. For the band, it's orchardcreekband.com. And there's a link on there where you can actually buy the physical CD if you prefer to do that, as some people like to do. That's there. And as I said, September 1st, it will be available on all the streaming platforms. And we'll be promoting, probably the first song we're going to actually promote from it is not the title track, but a gospel song that I wrote with Rick Lang, another bluegrass songwriter, called Nothing Left Undone, which is sort of about the idea of, you know, living your life so that come the end of your life, you feel like you've done everything you were supposed to do.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah,
didn't leave any loose ends untied or anything like that.
Yeah.
And that's been a song that a lot of people seem to like when we play it live. It's pretty rocking. So
yeah,
we'll be promoting that one as a single.
Awesome.
From the album.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think there's a great diversity of songs on there. There's some wonderful. Keith writes some great songs. He's got a great one about Nashville and his sort of nostalgia for old country music, which is wonderful. And Dave, the banjo player, writes some wonderful tunes, melodically very different than a lot of our other stuff, which is kind of cool. And Jan Springer has a great one that she co-wrote with Jerry Salley.
Yeah.
I think is really wonderful, based on the true story of Forrest Fenn, who was the fellow that buried treasure out here in the Rocky Mountains and then kind of left clues as to where it was. Some of the people that, you know, went searching for it didn't ever come back again.
Right.
And so it's about that.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to share all of that with us, and we're looking forward to the album dropping and catching you guys live somewhere, and certainly wish you well with it. I love your stories, and I love the stories behind your songs, and so definitely hope that the album does well for you guys.
Thanks.
Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of Americana Music Profiles. Find us on iTunes at Americana Music Profiles and on the internet at AmericanaRhythm.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.